In the United States, the incidence of obesity is increasing, particularly in the Deep South. The medical and economic consequences of obesity need urgent attention. Hello, I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Welcome to this week's Health Matters on Red River Radio. Over the next 60 minutes, we will be discussing the problem of obesity in our culture. We are fortunate to have a panel of experts who will be discussing the medical issues surrounding obesity, weight loss management, and the psychological aspects of obesity management. Joining us tonight are Dr. Anthony Stewart. Dr. Stewart practices internal medicine at Tri-State Internal Medicine. He has expertise in the medical management of obesity-related illnesses and the comprehensive evaluations of patients undergoing advanced treatments for obesity. We have Linda De La Cerda. Linda is a registered dietitian who works in the Willis Knighton's Weight and Wellness Solutions Program. She provides patient education and dietary support for patients with obesity and obesity-related illnesses. We also have Jan Burns. Jan is a licensed professional counselor who provides psychological support to obesity patients who are undergoing advanced treatments. Of course, tonight your questions are very welcome. Please call us at 800-552-8502 to be part of tonight's program. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. Dr. Stewart. Obesity is known to have associations with a number of medical conditions. What are the medical complications that you encounter most often in patients who have obesity?
Well, I think there's a lot of them. Probably the most feared is diabetes. I mean, that's just the huge shock when somebody's diagnosed with diabetes and they hasn't been on their radar, and you get to tell them that. But diabetes, acid reflux, and indigestion, GERD would be another big one. Sleep apnea is extremely common in patients with obesity and morbid obesity. Joint problems, ankles and knees, back pain, anxiety, depression. It just list goes on and on, conditions associated with obesity.
And you mentioned diabetes. That's certainly a condition that's increasing in an incidence in our population as well. I know there's a type 1 diabetes and a type 2 diabetes. Could you tell us about which is which and which is related to obesity?
Sure. Type 1 diabetes is typically found in children, and that's not really associated with weight issues or obesity. So type 2 is the type we're talking about when we say that you're at risk for diabetes with obesity, and that's becoming alarmingly more common, and the trends that show the increase of obesity over the last 30 years are mirrored by the increase in diabetes for that reason.
And if a patient has obesity and they feel like they need to be checked for diabetes, what's the most appropriate course of action for them?
Well, there's lots of different ways to check. One would be a fasting blood sugar, and some people might have a relative who has diabetes, and they can maybe borrow their meter, and if you fast overnight and don't eat, you can check your sugar. If the glucose is 126 or above, then that would be at the level that's considered diabetic. Now, with that, we'd always reconfirm that on another occasion, but that is one easy way that people could do it, possibly even home or certainly at their doctor's office with some blood work, fasting. Another test we use now that is also for diagnostic purposes would be the hemoglobin A1C. And that is a three-month average test that has a different number we look for. That's a blood test you can only get through your doctor or health care provider. And then another test that I think some of our ladies might be more familiar with would be the oral glucose tolerance test that they go through with pregnancy screening for gestational diabetes.
Well, that's very helpful information. Linda, we know that dietary factors are very important in the management of obesity. I think diets are very common in the population in general. How do dietary habits affect the tendency for some people to become overweight? And, you know, what's your approach to managing food intake during a weight loss program?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to consider is that people are individuals, and we can't just cookie cutter approach and hope for the same success across the board. We know that there's lifestyle factors that are definitely associated with obesity. Increased TV watching is definitely correlates with the incidence of obesity. But of course, we have the prevalence of 24/7 fast food. We eat out. We have fast-paced lifestyles. We don't cook. We eat on the run. I eat on the run over here. I mean, it's that's just our lifestyle. Lack of exercise is huge. I would think that is probably one of the number one problems that we're facing in our country. Our technology is continuing to allow us to progressively become sedentary, and that is to our demise as far as obesity goes. But as far as approaches to combat when we have someone who has obesity, we're really looking at, we've got to look at the whole picture. If we just hand them a diet, that's never going to fix the problem. They can go online if that's just what they want. Our weight and wellness program, as you mentioned earlier, is a multidisciplinary approach. We have the diet, but it's not just one diet. What we're trying to do is establish lifestyle behavior changes, because that's the only way you're going to have, someone's got to live in their real world to be able to have long-term success. But then we also add Jan on board, and she addresses what's up in their mind. 90% of their success is going to be dependent upon changing thought patterns, because if you don't change the way you're thinking, your actions are not going to change.
Jan, many patients with obesity may cite depression, anxiety, or even intense food cravings as part of their relationship to food. In your program, how do the psychological aspects of obesity factor into getting patients' results?
One of the first things that will help a patient is to first of all try to figure out why they're eating out of balance and how much that they are eating, because sometimes they eat for comfort. So we all like to be in a relationship. Sometimes because we're lonely, we'll eat. Sometimes just to have a relationship, I go out to eat. So therefore, I'm eating and I'm not being aware of what I'm eating, how much I'm eating. So therefore, I overindulge. And so therefore, we have a problem set up that we're using food, in essence, as a drug to try to comfort, to fill in the voids, to try to lift our spirits. And then, of course, that usually ends up in our being angry because we did what we did. We feel bad about that. Then we have great guilt. So the only way I can get out of this guilt cycle is to eat more. And then after I've eaten more, then I'm full of shame. So all of these emotions come into play that causes the problem, which I believe starts head first. We have to find out what is it that's causing me to make these choices when I have other healthier choices. And that's what we try to do in our weight and wellness program. Present them other ways of making a choice, and we do not try to use the word diet, because diet in my estimation is a negative word. It's got the word die in it, so therefore it's a negative word. So we like to use the term lifestyle changes, our choices, and that's what we try to present to the patients.
So you talk about guilt and shame, and I hear a lot of feedback from patients that, you know, they do socially isolate. I think many patients, especially the folks who tend to be quite obese, may feel that if they are out at a restaurant and they do have a large meal, that they will be shamed for that. And so do you see a cycle where patients do isolate when the obesity becomes more severe over time, and could that make the problem worse?
Absolutely. Isolation sets you up for eating by yourself, which implodes the problem, because now I am alone. Who wants to be with me? So I'm going to just eat more and bury my face. Of course, if a person is going through a highly emotional time, such as a divorce or a death in the family, they might find great comfort in food. And we are kind of a culture that uses food as a great reason to get together. But those who isolate, because they do feel full of shame, full of that people are watching them and judging them, and sadly, in our culture, a lot of the obese patients do feel judged, and that makes their self-esteem even lower. So therefore, how do they feel better? They isolate and they eat more and more, which capitulates the problem.
I can certainly understand that. Tonight we have our first caller, Jim from Shreveport. Jim, what's your question?
Yeah, I had that question about, you know, I tried to lose weight through dieting and all of that stuff for a long time, and I wonder what advice you would give people who try to do that and just can't succeed. When should they actually, you know, seek out professional help? Because that's what I did, and I've been able to lose a lot of weight with professional help over the last year and a half.
Dr. Stewart, when should someone who's interested in losing weight see their physician and have a frank discussion about why is what I've tried so far not working for me?
I think it depends on their BMI, your body mass index. If, you know, there's a big difference between saying I want to lose 10 pounds so I can look good for the beach season coming up and having a BMI that puts you in the morbid obese category or obese category. So I think it kind of depends where you are with that. And, most people before they come and see us will have already tried many different things, probably, you know, most, sometimes their whole life. They've been dieting back and forth, trying different things. So certainly most people we see who seek professional help have been through diets, have had their successes and failures, but ultimately weren't able to stick with it for whatever reason and have come to seek some help. So body mass index is something we'll throw around and talk about a lot. There are apps for that, as they say. You can get on the internet and plug in your height and weight and get your BMI. And certainly, if you're in the obese category, BMI above 30, I think that's certainly a line in the sand, where it's more than just being a little bit overweight or having a little extra in the midsection. It's going to be affecting your health. So I would say a BMI of 30 would be some place you could say, well, it's time to address this.
Tonight, our phone number for your questions is 800-552-8502. Again, the number is 800-552-8502. Dr. Stewart, you mentioned it may start to have effects on your health with a BMI of greater than 30. In a patient who may not be asking you about their weight and you take their history and do a physical exam and their BMI is at that level, what is the discussion that you normally initiate with that patient regarding their weight?
Right. Usually I'll just kind of tell them what the BMI is and explain what that number is and kind of use that as just, this is the definition, you know, this is what the numbers means. And, because this is where we are with, you know, either being obese or morbidly obese, we need to really think about trying to make some changes and taking some steps to address this. Because if you don't already have these things, you're certainly at risk for getting sleep apnea, diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, other problems. So that's kind of the way I'll go into those waters, and then kind of ask them what they've done before, and then kind of just listen to their story.
You mentioned sleep apnea as a complication of obesity. We may have listeners in the audience who have heard of sleep apnea, or many may have not. Could you tell us a little bit about sleep apnea and why does obesity factor into that?
Sure. Obstructive sleep apnea is a condition where patients, because they're overweight, they have more soft tissues in their throat and palate, and it's obstructive, meaning that because when you sleep, those things relax, the palate and the back of the tissues in the back of the throat relax, and the air is not able to flow through, so obstructing the flow of air when we're sleeping, usually oftentimes associated with snoring. Not all snorers have sleep apnea, but it's certainly one of the things we ask people when we talk about sleep apnea. And sometimes a spouse will say that they notice that the patient kind of stopped breathing. Apnea means not breathing. And then they'll kind of sputter and snore and kind of almost wake themselves up. And one of the things about sleep apnea is that you're just not getting good sleep. There's all kind of things, ramifications of that. When you don't sleep good, you don't feel good on any level. But when you're snoring and having obstruction of sleep, your oxygen levels can drop. You're getting these little micro awakenings at night, and you're not able to get into good REM sleep. And that's the good restorative sleep. So you're never able to get really in there as good as you should. So you wake up tired. You have oftentimes people will have AM headaches. They'll wake up in the morning with a headache. And then other questions we'll ask about sleep apnea would be, do you feel excessively sleepy during the day? If you get still, do you nod off? Those would all be things that if you're saying yes to any of these questions, you might be thinking about looking into that. And sleep apnea is not just a nuisance to yourself or your spouse if they're kicking you while you're snoring. But it really is a health issue, and can lead to changes in your heart structurally, pressures. So it's a real big issue that comes along with obesity.
So we certainly need to make sure that folks are aware of that. Excessive daytime sleepiness, as we call it, is a sign that you might need to be checked out for obstructive sleep apnea, especially if you have a high body mass index. Celeste from Lovelady, Texas is on the line. What's your question, Celeste?
I just had a question. It seems like every time I go to any kind of doctor's office or I pick up a magazine, there's so much advertising for the band or the bariatric surgery. And I was just wondering, what does a doctor go through stepwise to get to that point? And are we as a society looking for the quick fix of surgery? And what are the success rates, and do they continue on to be successful? I know personally several people that have had the surgery but then end up not in a good place.
I think that's an excellent question. Thank you for asking about that, Celeste. Dr. Stewart, what is the indication primarily for bariatric surgery?
Well, bariatric surgery is certainly not our first choice. It should not be really looked at. Unless you have the indications. The indications are BMI, again, body mass index of 40, which is morbid obesity, or you can be a BMI of 35 with comorbid conditions such as sleep apnea, diabetes, high blood pressure, these types of things. Those are the criteria. Now, different insurance companies will require different things, but those are the medical criteria. Some insurance companies will make you do a six-month medically supervised program prior to them paying for it. Some just don't pay for it at all. And some people will finance that themselves through a loan. But certainly the NIH states that you really should not be going straight to bariatric surgery unless you've failed all the other measures because it is surgery, certainly.
Yeah, and the long-term success rate, you know, tends to be an issue with any kind of an operation, especially in a population that may be at high risk. As you mentioned, they have diabetes, they have high blood pressure, they may have issues with right-sided heart failure. So in this difficult population, obviously a high-risk surgical population with a BMI greater than 40, what do you see as long-term success rates? Balancing out, obviously, we expect them to have improvements in their diabetes and blood pressure.
I think you see both stories. I think you see people who are the champions and do very well. I've had patients who are on 100 units of insulin a day with diabetes and all their kind of comorbid conditions. They get their surgery, they do well, they lose their weight, and they cure their diabetes. They're not diabetic anymore. They're off all medications. That happens, and that's when we all kind of get the big fist bump. That kind of stuff's exciting. And we see that with bariatric surgery, but certainly it's not foolproof. And I think, as Jan was saying, about the mind, you know, the thing we tell people is that, you know, you can get operated on. We operate on your stomach, not your brain. So if you're not doing the right things, you can beat anything, band, bypass. It really doesn't matter if you're not on board mentally doing the things you need to do. Then you're going to have some failures.
Yeah, it sounds like the case with any sort of elective surgery. We have our part as patients, so to speak, in taking care of ourselves after surgery to make sure when the surgeon's done their job and the other medical professionals have worked hard to make us better, that it's our job to take care of ourselves after surgery. We have Eric from Mesquite. Eric, what's your question?
Hi. I've been a little overweight my whole life. I wouldn't say obese, but maybe, you know, close to the definition. But I've got kind of an idea about how that whole thing works. You know, you've got skinny people and you've got, you know, chunky people. And I imagine it's something like a thermostat. Everybody, depending upon their genetics, is set a little bit different. Is that an accurate, idea of it?
That's a good question. Linda, what do you see when you have folks who may have a little bit of obesity and they come to you and they want maybe a diet and an exercise program, but maybe they don't. Maybe they just need a few little changes in their lifestyles to determine whether or not it's going to be a program they can sustain.
Well, and again, I think everybody is very unique and individual. And I like what Dr. Stewart said. You've got to find out what's going on with that person. I want to find out, you know, what kind of physical activity are they involved with? I mean, is this the caloric intake that they need without any exercise on board? Well, in that case, we could just simply add some exercise and probably have some really positive outcomes. I think one of the things that we try to focus on is wellness, though. Not just a number as far as a BMI, but we're also looking at the nutritional content of the diet. You know, do they feel good? I mean, you can eat 1,200 calories of junk, and you're not going to feel good. You might lose weight on the scale, but you're not still achieving the ultimate goal of overall good health outcome. So I think, you know, your weight is, does it affect your health? I like what Dr. Stewart was saying about that. That's a good indication. Just being a little bit overweight may not be a big deal for some people if they're physically active, that don't have health concerns. But if it is impacting your health, then that's going to be something that needs to be addressed. I do agree, everybody does have different metabolisms. It's not fair. I've been blessed with a high metabolism. I work with people who have very, very poor metabolism as far as that. But I think we can't hide behind that and say, I have no choice here. You know, yes, genetics is involved, but at the same point, we work with what we got. And that's, I think, an important
point. Well, I think genetics and environment, too. I mean, it's there's nature and nurture involved. Mm-hmm. And you can look at Western societies and compare to non-Western societies and see that there's a lot of nurture going on. And if you look at our diets over the last, you know, 30 years, the rise of obesity is not because our genetics have changed. They've not. We pass our genes down from family to family. It's because our lifestyles have changed. So I think that's just kind of what it is. On the flip side, don't get stuck on the BMI number. I mean, some of these things you can kind of just intuitively tell. If a guy's muscled up, if the BMI is not a great indicator. If you're the Rock, Dwayne Johnson, you know, whoever, linebacker for the NFL, your BMI is going to say you're obese, but you're not. You're just huge, you know. And another thing, if you're larger but you exercise, that's good. That's protective. They've looked at sumo wrestlers, and the sumo wrestlers who are the same weight as somebody who's not, you know, athletic and involved in those types of things. Their blood lipids and other things are much better than somebody who is the same weight but inactive. So I think activity is a big part of it.
I think what you mentioned is borne out in medical research. Correct me if I'm wrong. A patient who is obese, who is in an active wellness program, will actually experience improvements in their medical conditions as a result of their obesity, even if their weight loss is not stark. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
What about the patients who have sort of a borderline BMI, say it's 26 or so, but they're eating these high caloric density foods, and so they're not markedly obese, but they may have a little bit of glucose intolerance, a little bit of high blood pressure. What would their program look like compared to someone who has the higher BMI but is also diabetic or borderline?
Well, I think one of the things that you need to really consider, if it is glucose intolerance, then I'm going to be wanting to look at their carbohydrate intake, you know, especially refined carbs. We're going to really want to pinpoint that and try to decrease that.
What is a refined carb?
Refined carb is the mainstay of most of our diets. It is the opposite, where we have taken foods and processed them. It's basically your processed foods. It's not whole foods. We are trying to encourage whole fruits, vegetables, whole grains. That is more of the mainstay of a healthier diet. But trying to minimize, of course, we're going to eat processed foods, but how much? It's not so much a good food, bad food mentality, but how much, how often, and how you balance it out.
Thank you. Again, our number is 800-552-8502. You're listening to Health Matters on Red River Radio. Tonight's topic is obesity. Right now we have Chris from Shreveport calling. Chris, what is your question?
My question is there any type of mental profiling that needs to be done before a patient undergoes this type of surgery? For example, if they're like bipolar or have other mental issues that may not equip them to deal with this?
Linda, What is your response to that question? What is the psychological screening that's involved in a patient who may have morbid obesity, as we say? Or, I'm sorry, Jan, what is the psychological screening involved in a patient who may be under consideration for bariatric surgery?
If a patient has been diagnosed with a mental disorder, he could possibly be on some medications that could cause weight gain. So that needs to be under consideration. Secondly, one of the first things that I would always look for is any type of history of abuse, verbal, emotional, physical, sexual abuse, because these things tend to weigh people down. Lack of relationships, loneliness, any kind of emotional trauma. These things add to possibly some of the reasons as to why we choose to overeat. And so I would look strongly at these items before we would move forward.
And so in terms of mental illness, as a physician, I see patients who have mental illnesses that may be undiagnosed, such as depression, anxiety, adjustment disorders, past abuse. And then we have patients, as Chris mentioned, who may have a more formal psychiatric diagnosis, such as bipolar disorder. How does that distinction weigh into an evaluation for bariatric surgery in a patient who has morbid obesity?
Well, all things are considered before we write the psychosocial, and we look at those, we make sure the patient is aware of them. Research shows that it is wise for the patient to undergo psychotherapy for a year even after surgery is done. This is not only for preventive behaviors, but for probably ferreting out probably things that's been hidden and pushed down, so that the patient can deal with these things rather than cover them up and drown them with food.
In terms of the emotional trauma, is it advised that patients undergo preliminary psychotherapy getting ready for surgery?
I feel it would probably be in their best interest to deal with some of these matters first. That would help them solve some of the, or answer some of the questions as to, why am I eating so much? Why do I have to have second helpings? And it would probably help the patient.
What sort of questions should our patients be asking themselves if they're considering, maybe, you know, my weight has something to do with my emotional issues? Maybe I'm using it too much to medicate some old pain, or using it as a comfort.
You'd probably look at questions such as, why can't I be satisfied with one portion? Why do I feel like I have to go more? Why do I have to crave chocolate? And you could see how that could possibly even stem from a relationship, or the lack of a relationship with a person that was a chocolate freak. And so therefore they want to kind of network with that feeling. It kind of goes back to that emotion that perhaps they lacked that relationship. They would also look and they're snacking and trying to make them to be aware of, where are you eating? Why are you eating? How much are you eating? What do you feel like after you've finished eating? So it's kind of like moving into an awareness program where you're really aware of all the emotions that are going up, and also any kind of memories that might float forward, so that you can work on those.
Do you believe that there is a such thing as food addiction? Can we become addicted to chocolate, or, you know, I like ice cream and I think I could have a weakness for that? Is there a such thing as food addiction? Obviously, we all need food. We can't live without it. So how does that play into the psychological management of obesity?
Well, there's the compulsory part there. I have had two or three patients in the past that I felt like were strongly food addicts. They felt the overwhelming craving to stop at a drive-through and get whatever usually high fat density food. And it's that compulsory part of any type of addiction, that they have to have that food and they're so convinced that they have to. And so I definitely believe there is a food addiction where they have to overcompensate usually for for missing feelings and emotions or traumatized emotions.
So in a patient who may be undergoing an evaluation for bariatric surgery or even into a weight and wellness program, at what level does it become important for those issues to be addressed?
Well, as part of our program, it's all those things are kind of included. I mean, really, if you look at the NIH recommendations, a program should have all those components. You should have the dietary component, exercise, and behavioral therapy. And I think that's one of the big things that's missing is the behavioral therapy. You can go lots of places and get some kind of product. You know, most places are selling a product because they make money off the product, whether it's liquid diet type stuff or pills you got to take and all these types of things. But at the end of the day, most people aren't going to stay on that stuff forever. There are lots of things that can work, but nobody's going to eat just meat forever or, you know, no bread or only grapefruit or whatever the newest thing is. So again, we go back to that lifestyle thing. So I think that's the biggest issue is having all those components together. And again, it kind of goes back to just, I think is a bigger issue, the lack of mental health in general. There's definitely a shortage of mental health providers and something we need to try to fill the void in.
Again, our number is 800-552-8502. This is Health Matters on Red River Radio. Tonight we're discussing obesity. Red River Radio's Kate Archer-Kent recently reported on a finding from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. For the first time in 8 years, Mississippi is no longer the highest rated state for obesity. Louisiana has the highest. It's followed closely by Mississippi. Obesity rates for baby boomers have reached 40% in two states, Alabama and Louisiana, and are 30% or higher in 41 states. By comparison, obesity rates in seniors 65 years of old or greater exceed 30% in only one state, Louisiana. What are we doing in Louisiana that's making us so obese? Linda?
Well, I think education and our economy are definitely two driving forces there. Studies do confirm that with both males and females, lower education levels and lower economies are definitely going to be correlated with obesity. And it almost seems a little bit opposite but unfortunately a lot of your processed foods are going to be your cheaper foods. We have all kinds of bargains at our fast food places that we can supersize everything. But I think a lot of times also when you have a lower economic level, a lower education level, there's other lacks involved, other losses and deficits. And so people are looking to fill that void with food. That's one thing that they can still reach to for some kind of satisfaction. And so I do think those are two roles there.
Now, you mentioned education and income. It's interesting, the foundation report, more than 35% of adults ages 26 and older who didn't graduate high school are obese, compared to 21% of those who graduated from college or technical college. In terms of income, more than 31% of adults ages 18 or older who earned less than $25,000 per year were obese, compared with 25% of those who earn at least $50,000 a year. So in terms of our health education programs, what are we doing to reach these patients or these individuals who are of lower educational attainment or lower socioeconomic class? What are we doing to reach them?
Well, I think we got to start early. And there have been a lot of programs, national initiatives that are directed towards our children, to our school lunch programs, trying to provide healthier foundations, taking the junk food out of the vending machines, trying to promote physical education. I do think lack of knowledge is definitely an area that we're trying to address. As Dr. Stewart was talking about, you know, the culture, the nurturing, you know, what you learn at home is going to potentially defeat you for the rest of your life if if there's not a change. And so we are trying to start early. We do have children weight loss programs. And anytime we can get the parents involved on board, that's going to increase the effectiveness of it. Because if it can change as a family, we have hope. If we're just trying to reach the children as individual units, they're still going to go back to those same home environments.
Yeah, it sounds quite clear that it begins in the home. I think studies have shown that without parental involvement, impacting childhood obesity is such an arduous task. It's difficult for the public school system, for example, to undertake such an endeavor. Jan, in terms of the issues with obesity and folks who don't have a high education level or lower socioeconomic class, you know, we know those patients are at higher risk for mental health disorders as well, such as depression and anxiety. And many of those folks may actually have psychological diagnoses as well. What are we doing to touch that class of individuals who also have some of the psychological components of obesity?
There are agencies, I know there are Medicaid agencies that do have some qualified mental health therapists there, that is available. I know that we have some agencies like Samaritan Counseling, Center for Families, and others that have what we call a sliding scale so that these patients can get the psychological help that they need so that they can start making changes in the way they think and the way that they do.
It seems like that could be a vicious cycle. You know, if someone's unemployed or underemployed, and you know, certainly food is comforting, high density calories are readily available, and the treatment of depression with food, it seems like, could be pretty high risk for those individuals.
That's correct. Sometimes it's not just depression, sometimes it's somewhat negligence. For example, if the child comes home and the mother's at work and there's nothing to eat at the house except perhaps macaroni and cheese, they'll eat all the macaroni and cheese and just other things that are probably that they picked up that was processed foods, and so they're by themselves, and so we have this a lonely factor in there and this lack of being part of a whole family. And so that kind of cues in that emotion with eating those kinds of foods, so we continue with this cycle.
Yeah, and I think some of those kids are playing video games as well, so I
Correct.
Think that can lead to the habit of being sedentary and eating high caloric density foods. I believe we have another call, Eric from Mesquite. Eric, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you for taking my call again. I've got two questions. Can your body kind of be tricked into saving weight or not wanting to get rid of weight if you spend a lot of time in the AC versus out in the normal temperature? And also, are there any good, cheap, healthy foods out there?
Let's take your second question first. Linda, are there any cheap, healthy foods out there? Maybe growing your own food would be an alternative.
That's a great idea. Not too many of us are too skilled at that, though. We did actually, I remember even back in school, we did a budgeting project because we were working with WIC program. And oftentimes that is the excuse that we're given, is I just don't have money. And of course, food is costly. I don't care what you're buying anymore, but the thing that we did find is meat is your highest cost factor in a food budget. And so if you're actually cutting back on your meat, which is one of the things that we're encouraging to decrease our saturated fat, it does leave room for more whole foods, like we were talking about, less processed. And again, of course, it's just good consumerism is learning how to shop the bargains, get the coupons and such and so forth. I know, yes, the processed foods are cheaper. I do understand that. But if you do cut back on the meat, some of the impulse buying that we do, there you can budget it out so that you can to definitely increase the nutrient value of the foods.
Okay, I'll take a swing at your first question. You know, I think what has happened in terms of humans and food is that You know, to get where we are, we've gone through a lot of periods of famine, and our fat cells have become quite greedy. And so when we are exposed to high caloric foods, the fat cells are remembering maybe a couple of thousand years ago that they need to hang on to those calories. And I think with the advent of air conditioners, lower physical activity in general, our transportation has vastly improved. The genes in our fat cells are not really very much different than they were a couple of thousand years ago. And so I think we're not tricking the body's not tricking us into saving weight. I think it's sort of always been that way. And maybe we're ahead of our genetic code, so to speak, in that regard.
Well, I tell people it's kind of like the caveman thing. You know, if you're a hunter and gatherer and you're out there hunting and gathering, it's a lot of work. So you don't know when your next meal, you know, you may miss with your slingshot that, you know, that animal. So when you get lucky and hit one, your metabolism responds to that. So when you're eating, and your metabolism is going to change. It's going to slow down when you're not. So you know, people say, well, I'm just not going to eat. That's not always just the answer. You got to look at your metabolism too.
Also, I'd like to add that we crave what we consume. So if I have a steady diet of macaroni and cheese, mm-hmm. that's what I want is macaroni and cheese. Also, if what I am thinking about, and our thought processes, of course, are usually stimulated with TV, commercials, and when we see that item that has been photoshopped and computer enhanced, it's almost as if sometimes we can smell that item. And so because I'm thinking about it, I want to go purchase that, or I want to go buy that particular item. So we have all the media that continues to play into our thinking, which to me is the beginning of to improve your lifestyle changes is when I change the way I think.
Yeah, I think with the media, it's pretty clear that, you know, food consumption is a pretty strong driver of our economy. So I don't know that we're going to see large changes in that anytime soon. You know, Dr. Stewart, you hear from many folks that they may be exercising and not losing weight, and the concept of fat burning more calories than muscle always, or muscle burning more calories than fat always comes up. Is that fact or fiction?
It's fact. I mean, your lean tissue does burn more calories than fat, and I think there's something to that.
You know, the New England Journal of Medicine recently published an article regarding myths and assumptions of obesity, and one myth that's pointed out is that you know, large rapid weight loss is associated with poorer long-term weight outcomes than is slow gradual weight loss. And it sounds like maybe that's not true, that large rapid amounts of weight loss can be sustained. Have you experienced that?
Well, I think one of the things that I think in terms of the rapid weight loss, yes, I think that motivates people. You jump start and you start losing weight, and they are much more motivated to continue making those changes as long as they see the results. I think the downside about rapid weight loss is that it usually is accomplished with fad diets, something that is not going to be able to be sustained. It's not going to be promoting your lifestyle changes that is going to allow for long-term success. So I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with initially starting faster than maybe what the old school has promoted. But at the same point, we're looking at the long term, the underlying foundation of how is this going to be promoted and sustained.
Another myth that's pointed out in this article is very interesting. Small sustained changes in energy intake or expenditure will produce large long-term weight changes. So if it requires 3,500 calories per pound deficit to lose a pound, if I can eliminate 100 calories per day, that would mean I would lose a pound a month, and over 5 years that would be 60 pounds. But as it turns out, that's not true.
And that is correct. Now we do try to push for those small changes because we got to start somewhere, and most people don't start big.
Yeah, we talk about using the stairs, parking farther right. away from the entrance, and things like that.
Right. And that does add up, because it does, I think evidence shows that if I start making positive changes, that's going to promote more positive changes. But I think what they're trying to indicate is I can't just have a deficit of 100 calories a day and not think that I've got to do some other things, because first of all, you're going to have a smaller body mass that's not going to have as many calories to sustain it. But if I'm just got 100 calories a day, I'm going to probably accomplish finding that 100 calories another day. And so I think that's another concept. There's got to be, it's got to be the overall approach. I've got to be looking at my physical activity. I've got to be looking at my intake and my habits.
Jan, we hear a lot about dietary supplements. Psychologically, a number of these may have stimulants. Do you see that as a psychological issue regarding weight control?
It would probably depend on, I would think, their general health, especially with the stimulants. It does not, again, it's, I think like Dr. Stewart had said, it's got a beginning and an ending, so you're not going to be taking this pill your entire life. So it's kind of, you may have a good start, and then you might lose focus and balance, and so therefore you end up probably worse than you were before you started. So I don't see that stimulants are going to help, especially psychologically, except for maybe just at the beginning for that feel-good rush, and then I think probably even more depression, because now I'm back to where I started, especially after I stopped taking the medication.
Again, our number is 800-552-8502. This is Red River Radio, and you're listening to Health Matters. We're talking about obesity. We mentioned stimulants. Dr. Stewart, what are the common forms of weight loss medications that are available?
Probably the most written medicine is called Atipex, and this is a stimulant, and it's been around. It's widely used. It's fairly cheap. So this is the one that has been most prevalent. And people will have success as far as by the book. 12 weeks usually is what is recommended short-term use for Atipex. Certainly some people will use it longer, but that's what it's intended for. And I think in some cases it can do fine. It can give people a little boost in the beginning. They sort of realize when they stop taking the medicine, if they haven't accompanied that medicine with lifestyle changes, exercise, and a good foundation of the diet, then it's not going to be lasting at all. So Atipex would be the most common, what would previously the most common medicine. There's another medicine that's a fat blocker. There's an over-the-counter version, Ally, and Zinical is the prescription name, which is a little bit stronger than the over-the-counter version. And this is a medicine that blocks fat absorption. So if you're not absorbing the fat when you eat it, it's going to come out in your stool. And that's probably the biggest gripe with that medicine, is that if you are not careful and you eat the cheese pizza, then you're going to have some problems. Cramping and all kind of good words we can put on the radio. The package insert says you should bring an extra pair of drawers from the South, if you would, with you, just in case you have some spotting. So you just gotta be, I think it's probably a good motivator to not eat fat food once you have that experience. But that drug has been shown to be effective, and it doesn't have a lot of issues. The stimulants like Atipex, if you have hypertension, heart disease, other problems, that's just not an option for you. So the fat blocker medicines, Zinical or Ally over the counter, is an option for more patients. You do need to take a fat soluble vitamin because take a multivitamin because it'll block some of your fat soluble vitamins A, E, D, and K. So that's important to remember when you're taking that medicine. Really, we've had a real sparsity of medicines when it comes to weight loss drugs, and thankfully we've had a few new ones that have come across the FDA. There have been drugs before that had promised, but they just didn't make it. There have been some that are taken off the market due to significant problems in the past, FinFin, these types of things. So some new ones that you might have heard about. One is called Belvique. And this is a serotonin agonist, where serotonin receptor agonist
that helps people lose weight. It's fairly new. Controlled class 4 drug, but it's something that at least we have in our toolbox to try. Besides the things I mentioned previously, another drug that's been recently approved by the FDA is called Qsymia, and this is a combination really of two medicines that we've had for a while. One is Atipex that we talked about before, and the other is Topamax, a medicine that previously had not been approved for weight loss, but that did have the nice effect of causing some weight loss. So those Atipex and Topamax are now in one pill called Qsymia, which is approved by the FDA for long-term treatment of obesity. And again, this is another good option. So it's one of these things you just got to get with your experience with and kind of see how these things play out and get comfortable using some of these medicines. But it's nice to at least have a few more options. There are lots of drugs that have the side effect of losing some weight. So that's one thing people need to think about is there a medicine I could take for this condition that might help me lose a little weight? And some examples would be if you're a diabetic, metformin tends to cause people to lose some weight. So that would be a good choice, I think, for all diabetics if they can take it. They don't have a contraindication. But for weight loss purposes as well, there are injectable medicines for diabetes, Byetta, Victoza, Bydureon, that help slow gastric emptying and lose weight. And some people have had pretty good results on that with weight loss. So that's another option that if my sugar is not at control, my doctor said my hemoglobin A1C is not where it needs to be, maybe we could look at these options. So there are medicines out there for depression. Some of those, as Jan mentioned, can cause weight gain, and some are not as problematic for that. So just looking at some of your comorbid problems and trying to kind of hit two birds with one stone when you're getting your medicine regimen together.
It sounds like obviously drugs are not without risk, and folks should definitely talk to their physician about a comprehensive program when considering using a medication to lose weight. Dr. Stewart, at what level of obesity would you say a weight loss medication is worth considering?
Certainly, if you're a BMI of 30, considered obese, then you'd qualify. If you're 27 with some comorbids, that would also be indicated. So this is not the I have a wedding in 2 weeks and I want to take some Atipex to fit into my dress. That's really not responsible. The bride's heart will be racing fast enough without a stimulant. So really it needs to be 27 with comorbids or 30 with no comorbids necessary.
Linda, I think the rave now is to cut carbs, so to speak. A few years ago it was to decrease fat in the diet, especially saturated fats. Is there a better strategy for weight loss, or is it basically checking the balance sheet? How much are we burning versus how much are we taking in?
I definitely think the balance is the bottom line key. I do look at the individual components because the refined carbs definitely, I'm not looking at reducing your carbs that come from whole fruits and whole grains, but I am looking at decreasing our refined carbs because that's where we're running into issues where with some people, you're going to start having spikes with blood sugar when there's a large intake of your processed carbs. And then the body responds with the outflow of the insulin. And then there is this whole process where I've got increased hunger. I'm more apt to be storing fat. And so those are not going to, and they're not satisfying. I could eat refined carbs ongoing and never really get full. Whereas if I'm going to be looking at things that contain fiber, fiber is definitely a big part of the diet that we do encourage with weight loss. Fiber helps make you feel full. So I am looking at trying to make sure that we're getting adequate sources of fruits and vegetables and whole grains to be aiming for most people, 20, 25 grams of fiber a day.
So 20 to 25 grams of fiber per day, what does that look like in terms of, you know, when I go to work, I'm going to take some fiber to eat along the way so I'm not tempted to grab that donut at 10 a.m. or so?
Well, I mean, if you're looking for things that are portable, things that I can take on the run, fruits, you know, apple would be a way to do it. A sandwich. I talk to a lot of patients who are not breakfast eaters, but I say you can put a sandwich together, two slices of whole wheat bread the night before and run out the door with it. There's lots of bars that are going to have be sources of fiber and protein. Protein and fiber are both going to have a sense of fullness that is going to be promoted, and that's going to have it's going to carry you further than if I'm just eating the donut, like you said.
You know, there's one presumption that we have. You mentioned, eating breakfast. In this New England Journal of Medicine article, a presumption is that eating regularly versus skipping breakfast is protective against obesity. But we really don't have any evidence to support that that's actually true. What do you tell patients about breakfast?
Well, dietitians are known to be promoting breakfast. I think it's more the whole intake, though. You know, the old saying to eat breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, and then supper like a pauper is definitely going to be an approach, and it's opposite of what we do. So what we are trying to encourage is a larger intake of food in the earlier hours of the day when we are more active, and to have a decreased intake as we go into the later hours of the day. I do work with people who are not breakfast eaters, and their thought is, as soon as I start eating breakfast, I'm hungrier throughout the day. That's usually short-lived, and I still, even though the study didn't confirm it, I still find that people overall, if they do include some form of food in the beginning part of the day, they're going to do better.
You know, there's another thing that we hear a lot, don't eat after 7 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so if I skip breakfast, am I going to have that, you know, dozen donuts at 11 o'clock? Is there any truth to that, skipping the late evening snack or not eating after 7 p.m.?
The experience I have is that if I'm eating throughout the day, multiple times through the day, I'm usually going to find myself more satisfied than allow myself to skimp all day long and come to the end of the day starved, like Jen has alluded to. Is there's a lot of maybe stress that I'm processing at that time of the day, and then I'm going to walk in my house, and then, yes, I am going to be more apt to run for the food.
So a regular, well-balanced diet, and try not to do too little or too less at any one particular time of the day.
Is it good?
Well, I would like to thank Linda De La Serta, Jan Burns, and Dr. Anthony Stewart for their input on today's Health Matters at Red River Radio. I think the program has been quite enlightening for those of us who suffer from obesity, and we certainly look forward to hearing from you guys again soon. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Tonight's program was engineered by Kermit Poling, with production assistance from Bill Beckett, Wally Derleth, Iman Bader, and Daniel Gordy. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.